matter, given the anarchic economy, Herbert summoned Huck to the governor's palace. He presented the visitor with a typewritten resignation letter and browbeat him into signing it. Huck and Huck's ministry were a menace to good government and security, the governor subsequently explained to the viceroy. A ministry, minus the caste Hindus who constituted a number of Huck's associates, would, in Herbert's view, be infinitely better than the ministry which has gone, if it is to be remembered, as it hardly ever is in Bengal politics, that the war has to be won and the Congress rebellion kept under. For Herbert, retaining firm control over Bengal's policies meant working with the Muslim League, which was eager to supplant Huck's coalition. In Bengal, Muslims formed 55% of the population, with almost all the remainder Hindu. The 1935 Indian constitution had, however, given 119 seats in the legislature of Bengal to Muslims and only 80 to Hindus. The seats confiscated from Hindus had gone to Europeans, who, although comprising only 0.04% of Bengal's population, held 10% of the seats. Fazlul Huq, a moderate Muslim, had scraped together the numbers for a ministry with the help of Hindu politicians left over after those belonging to the Congress had gone to prison. With Huq out of the way, the so-called European group of legislators, mainly representing British business interests, could help loyalist Muslims form a government. In 3 weeks, Bengal was being governed by a Muslim League ministry headed by Sir Khawaja Nazimuddin, advertised as undoubtedly a friend of the British. While bemoaning the governor's unorthodox methods in having forced Huck's resignation, the viceroy trusted that Nazimuddin would lend much more effective support to the war effort than we were ever able to get from Huck. The rare British administrator who empathised with the natives was also eased out of power. The most senior civil servant in Bengal, Chief Secretary James Richard Blair, asked for early retirement, reportedly because he could not stomach the repression in Midnapore. Blair had related some of his concerns about Bengal's governance to Amory. Still, when the viceroy decided in another few months that the governor himself was incompetent and needed to go, the Secretary of State for India demurred. Herbert had handled the difficult ministry well on the whole and given good support to the military authorities. Each link in the command chain, Churchill, Amory, Linlithgow, Herbert, was welded to the others by a grim resolve. The war has to be won and the Congress rebellion kept under, as Herbert had put it. The care and feeding of the populace was not a priority. The authorities worried only about how to keep the soldiers and war workers safe, didn't think about keeping the people safe, related social worker Ashoka Gupta. Fish, eggs, fruit, everything was being collected and fed to the army. Big rice banks were formed. They told everyone, "Give us your rice, we'll give it back to you when you need it," but they didn't give any, even after people started dying. Chapter 5 Death of a Thousand Cuts. I am glad to learn from the Minister of War Transport that a strict line is being taken in dealing with requests for cereals from the Indian Ocean area. A concession to one country at once encourages demands from all the others, the Prime Minister commented in a memo on March 10, 1943. They must learn to look after themselves, as we have done. The grave situation of the UK import programme imperils the whole war effort, and we cannot afford to send ships merely as a gesture of goodwill. For 3 months, Viceroy Linlithgow had been warning about a food crisis in India, and earlier that March, a member of his council, Sir Ramaswamy Mudaliar, had told the War Cabinet's Shipping Committee of some danger of famine conditions, particularly in Calcutta and Bombay. Wheat was available in Australia, but all Indian ships capable of the round trip were engaged in the war effort. Moreover, in January, the Prime Minister had brought most of the merchant ships operating in the Indian Ocean over to the Atlantic in order to bolster the United Kingdom's stocks of food and raw materials. He was reluctant to release vessels to carry grain to the colony because lowered stocks at home would compromise the British economy and limit the War Cabinet's ability to pursue military operations of its choice, and because his hostility toward Indians was escalating. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sir Kingsley Wood, had long been warning that India had erased its traditional debt to the United Kingdom and was instead becoming a major creditor. The sterling debt owed to the colony was mounting at £1 million a day. It would fall due right after the war, just when a ravaged, if liberated, Europe would have to be fed. Food in the post-war era would be scarce worldwide and expensive to import, and His Majesty's government would already be bankrupt from paying for the war. In consequence, maintaining British food stocks had become crucially important to the War Cabinet, and the debt to India a source of profound frustration. On September 16, 1942, Amory had recorded in his diary, "Winston burbled away endlessly, the general theme being that it was monstrous to expect that we should not only defend India and then have to clear out, but be left to pay hundreds of millions for the privilege. The Secretary of State for India strove to explain that the debt had little to do with the defence of the colony, but arose from its contributions in manpower and materials to the war in the Middle East and North Africa. It is an awful thing dealing with a man like Winston, who is at the same moment dictatorial, eloquent, and muddle-headed," Amory wrote 8 days later. "I'm not sure that I ever got into his mind that India pays for the whole of her defence, including the British forces in India, or that there is no possible way of reducing these accumulating balances except by stopping to buy Indian goods or employing Indian soldiers outside India." The Prime Minister announced at a War Cabinet meeting that the sterling debt should be neutralised by a counterclaim, a bill presented to India for its defence by the United Kingdom. At the very least, he insisted, the financial agreement forged in April 1940 should be revised to make the colony pay more of the costs of the war. Viceroy Linlithgow had already warned against this course of action. "If any suggestion were made that it was doubtful whether India would in due course receive value for her sterling balances, the reaction on India's war effort could not fail to be disastrous. Should the United Kingdom signal its desire to renege on its financial commitments, then industrialists, contractors, and even peasants would anticipate a drop in the value of the rupee and balk at supplying goods for cash." The sterling debt arose from the fact that commodities were being continually drawn from India with no recompense beyond the promise of payment in the future. The indiscriminate printing of paper money was enabling the government of India to acquire supplies for the war effort, both within the country and without. But the situation was volatile. Inflation was poised to combine with a shortage of every necessity of life to bring disaster to the colony's poor. Amory did not anticipate that the government of India's warning of August 1942 that inflationary financing might lead to famines and riots would actually come to pass. He was, however, cognizant of the risk posed by such a method of war financing to the war effort itself. Should Indians come to believe that His Majesty's government would not keep its promises, the torrent of supplies from the colony would dry up. Winston cannot see beyond such phrases as, "Are we to incur hundreds of millions of debt for defending India in order to be kicked out by the Indians afterwards?" Amory confided to his diary. "But that we are getting out of India far more than was ever thought possible, and that India herself is paying far more than was ever contemplated when the present settlement was made, and that we have no means of making her pay more than she wants, or supplying goods unpaid for, is the kind of point that just doesn't enter into his head." The Prime Minister was aware that the sterling debt was inverting the economic relationship between colony and coloniser. After the war, money would flow from Britain to India, not as investment to be repaid with interest, but as remittance. Whatever the romance of empire, a colony that drains the exchequer is scarcely worth having, and that reality, notes historian Dietmar Rothermund, would make it easier for India to be finally released. Another source of irritation to Churchill was the 1940 US Republican presidential candidate, Wendell Willkie. In an October 1942 broadcast, he reported to Americans what he had learned on a world tour. When the aspirations of India for freedom were put aside to some future unguaranteed date, it was not Great Britain that suffered in public esteem in the Far East, Willkie said. It was the United States. The inhabitants of Asia cannot tell from our vague and vacillating talk whether we really do stand for freedom or what we mean by freedom. Willkie's criticism induced President Roosevelt to reiterate that the Atlantic Charter applied to the entire world and to appoint a seasoned diplomat, William Phillips, as his personal representative with the rank of ambassador to India. Apparently stung by the disapproval emanating from the United States, Churchill made on November 11, 1942, what would become his most quoted pronouncement on India. "We mean to hold our own," he declared in Parliament. "I have not become the King's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire." According to Amory, the next day he went off the deep end in a state of frantic passion on the whole subject of the humiliation of being kicked out of India by the beastliest people in the world next to the Germans. It was at this inopportune juncture that the Viceroy had begun to press the Secretary of State for India to arrange for imports of wheat. He further cautioned, "I think it probable that until our own position becomes clearer, we shall have to stop all exports of food grains." After the fall of Rangoon in March 1942, the government of India had undertaken to supply Ceylon and Arabia with the rice that they used to import from Burma. But in a series of telegrams starting that December, Linlithgow warned Amory that cyclone and subsequent pest infestations in Bengal and a failure of monsoon rains in Madras had caused a serious deterioration in food situation in India. The rice crop was hardest hit, and what with ongoing exports, it would fall short by something over 2 million tons. Wheat and other cereals would possibly be in excess, but the war effort in India and abroad would absorb much of that surplus, leaving a worrisome overall shortage of 1 million tons of cereals. The stringency anticipated for later in the year was causing many people to stock up on grain, making matters much worse than might be gauged from the numbers alone. The government of India would subsequently calculate a gap between rice production and consumption of 2 million tons in Bengal alone, with a 3.5 million ton shortage in India overall, including export and defence requirements, for the fiscal year that ended on March 31, 1943. That implies a shortfall of the same order for 1943 as a whole. The actual extent of the rice shortage in Bengal remains controversial to this day. "I am very uneasy about position that is rapidly developing," the Viceroy cabled to Amory on December 13, 1942. Requests for grain were pouring in from the provinces, and the governor of Bombay had threatened to disperse the entire city in the countryside if he did not get 50,000 tons of wheat within a month. The effects of shortages, the Viceroy erroneously believed, would be confined to urban and industrial areas. But those, as you know, are precisely the most inflammable areas in some ways from the political point of view, he continued. A new crop of wheat would be harvested in May, but until then the situation would be acute, and he urgently needed 600,000 tons of wheat to arrive by the end of April 1943. The government of India had been caught unawares by the Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia. Any threat to India had been presumed to emanate from the borders of the Soviet Union, the British Empire's traditional rival in the region, which was why vital ammunitions factories had been placed as far east as feasible around Calcutta. Worse, the authorities had failed to anticipate that rice imports might be cut off by Japanese conquest and had not planned for any stringency in its supply. Instead, they had encouraged jute cultivation in Bengal, reducing the fields available to rice by 2.7 million acres. Although aware of the significance of wheat, which grew in the cooler climes of the northwest and was essential for feeding the army, the government had failed to control the supply of that grain as well. In December 1941, for instance, the authorities had imposed ceilings on the price of wheat. Even in meticulously managed Britain, however, the Food Ministry could keep down bread prices only by maintaining adequate stocks of wheat and releasing it to the market as required. The government of India did not have the stocks to enforce price controls. Sellers had refused to accept the new prices, so that little wheat could thereafter be found on the open market. Subsequently, the authorities had decided that India was too large to administer in its entirety, and instead had empowered each province to protect its own people. That had frozen the grain trade among the provinces. It is only human nature that if you give a province power to prevent grain going out of its border, that province will look to its own safety, Robert Hutchings of the Department of Food would explain to the Famine Commission. The government next undertook to purchase grain from surplus provinces such as Punjab in the northwest and to send it to short provinces such as Bengal, but failed to procure enough. The problem was that cultivators of the northwest were enjoying a double windfall. Their soldier sons were remitting paychecks, and their wheat was more in demand than ever before. Instead of selling, farmers were holding out for higher prices. Indeed, many preferred to keep their savings in the form of grain because they had come to distrust the value and security of cash. An intelligence report noted a widespread fear that after the war the United Kingdom would revise the exchange rate between the rupee and the sterling, thereby slashing the wartime earnings of Indians, as had happened after World War I. Nor could officials use coercion to extract wheat from the northwestern province of Punjab, as they had forcibly claimed the produce of Bengali villagers. Maintaining army morale meant pleading with, rather than threatening, the families of Punjabi soldiers. As Linlithgow would subsequently explain to Amory, he did not want to antagonize the helpful ministry that held power there, or to upset cultivators whose sons were in the army. One had to consider, he wrote, the reaction on the very large numbers of the Punjab soldiers of every religion and community who are serving overseas of the receipt of letters from the province representing that their houses were being invaded and their families insulted under the pretext of requisitioning and that their legitimate claims out of food profits were being taken from them. On January 2, 1943, Governor Herbert warned the Viceroy that his province was desperately short of wheat. Bengal's normal demand is 18,000 tons a month, and we are short of nearly twice this amount over last quarter alone. Amount of 110 tons mentioned by you, therefore, represents only few hours' supply. If factory workers who ate wheat did not get it, they would either riot or leave, so the shortage threatened the production of ammunition. Herbert urged Linlithgow to get hold of a ship for large-scale import of wheat, which might prove palliative for the whole situation involving both wheat and rice. Amory had already responded on December 15, 1942, that ships were in such short supply that the United Kingdom's own imports were cut to bone and involve serious inroads into stocks both of food and of materials. The War Cabinet wanted assurance that, if it acceded to the Viceroy's request, India would continue monthly exports of 30,000 tons of rice to Ceylon. It also desired confirmation that all ships registered in India were under full control so as to afford maximum utilization for war effort. For the time being, Linlithgow responded, he could spare 12,000 tons a month for Ceylon and some more for Arabia. Of India's larger ships, 17 had been requisitioned, and the remaining 9, although still in private hands, were plying military stores and the most essential civil supplies along the Indian coast or to the Red Sea. But Commander-in-Chief Wavell was so concerned about food shortages that he would forego up to 180,000 tons of war materials if the shipping space could instead be used to bring wheat. So in early January 1943, Amory wrote to Lord Frederick Leathers, the Minister of War Transport, arguing the urgent necessity of sending to India 600,000 tons of wheat within the first quarter of the year, over and above 30,000 tons already promised to the army. The imports would enable the Viceroy, firstly, to maintain supplies to the army, secondly, to feed the urban population on whose labour the war effort mainly depends, thirdly, to maintain supplies to those areas where, for one reason or another, there is an unsatisfied deficiency of food grains, and fourthly, to convince holders of supplies that holding for a major shortage is not good business. Amory was talking to the wrong person. Leathers was a former shipping magnate who had been brought in by Churchill to run the British Empire's merchant shipping during the war. He was reputed to be very competent, but he lacked the authority and, by all accounts, the inclination to release ships for any purpose that the Prime Minister had not approved. Nor was the timing propitious. Gandhi, who remained in custody, appeared to be embarking on a fast, sparking anxiety in London because of the likelihood that it would influence opinion in Washington. According to Amory, Churchill began the War Cabinet meeting of January 7 with a terrific tirade against apologizing for the Empire, appeasing the Americans, etc. On January 10, 1943, Amory received an even more desperate plea from India's Department of Food. The Army's wheat reserve would run out in a month. The remainder of the wheat promised to the army was waiting in Australia and must be brought in by February, and if shipping could not right away be found for 600,000 tons, at least 200,000 tons must come by April. The vital necessity for expedition cannot be exaggerated, as we have to carry on with practically no supplies for civil population till some of these shipments arrive, the officials warned. It was too late. On January 5, 1943, the Prime Minister had slashed the number of ships operating in the Indian Ocean area. The term used in connection with wartime shipping referred to the entire span of water rimmed by Australia, Arabia, and Africa, as well as the British Empire territories and dominions surrounding this composite body of water. The United Kingdom controlled the merchant ships there, whereas the United States ran the Pacific. Of the 40 vessels that remained in the Indian Ocean area after the cut, the lion's share would go toward supplying Operation Torch, an invasion of French colonies in North Africa, leaving only a handful of ships to ply to and from India, just enough to collect whatever goods the colony could still provide to the outside world. Churchill seems not to have mentioned this crucial decision when, at a War Cabinet meeting on January 12, 1943, Amory brought up India's serious food problem. Instead of wheat shipments, the War Cabinet offered to send to the colony an official who had experience, from a stint in the Middle East, of prying grain out of cultivators. Unusually for the Prime Minister when India came up, he was full of internal glee, because, it turned out, he was shortly to depart for Casablanca to meet the US President. At the Casablanca conference, a misunderstanding between American and British planners precluded a realistic allocation of shipping to different theatres. The British wanted to focus their war initiatives on the Mediterranean region and persuaded the Americans to participate in an attack on Sicily in July. American generals, in contrast, wanted a cross-channel assault on France by September, to which Churchill nominally agreed. But the battles around the Mediterranean would absorb so many resources that the landing in Normandy would have to be postponed until 1944. The Allies also agreed upon Operation Anakim, a plan involving a seaborne assault on Burma. although the cut in vessels in the Indian Ocean would deprive the forces based in India of essential war materials and had doomed the invasion even before it could be launched. Anakim would eventually be cancelled, so that India ceased to be an important war base until the very end of 1943. But the colony remained responsible for feeding 2 million troops, whether or not they fought. While Churchill and Cherwell were away in Casablanca, Amory described India's plight to a shipping committee and warned of dissident elements gaining leverage from the food shortages. The committee determined that ships with a carrying capacity of between 40,000 and 50,000 tons, then loading for the United Kingdom at foreign ports, should instead take wheat to India. Cabling the Viceroy, Amory suggested that Indian ships supplying the war effort in the Middle East might also be released to ferry a total of 130,000 tons. These ships were not, in fact, made available. HMG regret that they find it impossible at this stage, in view of the heavy sacrifices already assumed on behalf of India and of the present pressure from all sides on our shipping, to consider your further request for 400,000 tons, Amory concluded. 4 days later, on January 20, the Government of India informed the Secretary of State for India that it was dispensing with price controls on wheat, and in another few days it approved the Bengal government's decision to do the same with rice. An official paper attributed the action to the desperate straits in which the authorities found themselves. The Viceroy explained to the province's governors on February 3 that although some wheat was on the way, with regard to the rice problem, no help can be expected from outside the country, and we are forced back on our own resources. The timing of the decision to lift price controls is significant. It indicates that a sudden realization of the stranglehold on shipping, along with supplies being set to run out within weeks, prompted the government of India to give up on trying to control the economy and instead buy up all the grain it could get. So the cut in shipping, or more broadly put, the prioritization of the United Kingdom's needs over those of the colonies, motivated the February 13 order to go to any place and purchase at any price that detonated the famine in Bengal. The Allied shipping crisis had built up slowly but inexorably. During 1942, German U-boats, operating mainly in the Atlantic Ocean, had taken a heavy toll, sinking 1.3 million gross tons of British-controlled shipping in the last quarter alone. The build-up of forces for Operation Torch in North Africa had also absorbed many more shiploads of supplies than had been anticipated. The Minister of War Transport had met that contingency by withdrawing ships from the Indian Ocean and from the United Kingdom civilian program, so that the rate at which imports reached the island nation had fallen to less than half of what it had been before the war. The United Kingdom intended to bring in 27 million tons of food and raw materials in 1943, plus around 15 million tons of liquids, mostly petroleum. In November 1942, British representatives had approached President Roosevelt with a request for 7 million tons of American shipping toward the dry cargo import program. The President had acquiesced, but told them that some of the ships were in use and might not be released for 3 months. At the S-Branch, Lord Cherwell's most trusted assistant, Donald MacDougall, became concerned that imports were not arriving fast enough. Roy Harrod, the more experienced economist, had left by that time. MacDougall was convinced that if the United Kingdom did not get more shipping for civilian needs, stocks of food would quite possibly fall to dangerously low levels before very long. He figured that stocks could, however, be adequately protected by cutting the number of ships serving the Indian Ocean area down to 60% and bringing the rest over to the Atlantic to serve the import program. I told Prof he would never get away with such a dramatic reduction and had better suggest 80, MacDougall related in his memoir. He replied that, on the contrary, he would put in 40 to 50, which would be argued up by the military to my figure of 60, which he believed. Thus was born one of Churchill's most far-reaching decisions. On January 2, 1943, the Prof informed the Prime Minister that the United Kingdom's imports would increase by 1 million tons if the 90 monthly sailings to the east were cut to 50 during January, February and March, and by 1.25 million tons if the cut were to 40 sailings. Moreover, the gain would be increased to 3.5 millions if the cut were prolonged up to the end of June. A more nuanced calculation, taking into account the delay in transferring ships from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic, would find that the last cut actually yielded 2 million tons of imports. Failing such strong action, factories will have to close down for lack of materials, with all the political repercussions this involves, Cherwell asserted. Although the first option seemed enough to meet the United Kingdom's needs, the memo did not state that, nor did it mention any negative consequences of such cuts. Accordingly, Churchill circled the most drastic, last option, marked it A, and wrote on the memo, "We must go for A." Thanks to the Prof, MacDougall's suggestion to cut Indian Ocean shipping down to 60% ended up as an even deeper cut, to 44%, and for twice as long. Ships that went to the Indian Ocean generally made loops, going from port to port within the region before heading back to the United Kingdom or the United States. Combined with the imperative to supply troops in North Africa, the shipping cut meant that very few vessels would be available on the run between Australia and India. The shipping cut must portend violent changes and perhaps cataclysms in the seaborne trade of large numbers of countries, the Ministry of War Transport warned the Prime Minister. As ships gradually left the Indian Ocean, the cessation of trade deranged the economies of the colonies on its rim. They were already reeling from wartime inflation and scarcity, and the menace of famine suddenly loomed up like a hydra-headed monster with 100 clamouring mouths, related CBA barons in the official history of wartime British shipping. Desperate appeals began pouring into colonial offices. Several British possessions bordering the Indian Ocean, such as Kenya, Tanganyika, and British Somaliland, suffered famine that year. Historians attribute the calamities to a combination of drought, wartime inflation, acquisition of grain for the armed forces, and hoarding by Indian traders. That all the famines, including the one in Bengal, occurred in 1943 suggests, however, that the shipping cut also played a role. In the Indian Ocean area, the burden of paying for victory shifted from place to ease the weight, finally came to rest, summarized Barons. On January 6, 1943, the Viceroy of India relieved his hectic schedule with a duck shoot in a princely state. The party boasted 52 guns and bagged 2,310 birds on a single winter's day. A political crisis was flaring up at that time, and it, too, involved starvation. Gandhi was depressed. His personal secretary had died shortly after having been arrested. His countrymen were in desperate straits, and because he was in custody, he was unable to help them. Moreover, palpable departures from the truth in the government's portrayal of recent events were adding to his distress. Gandhi asked for an audience with the Viceroy to explain his reasons for having launched the Quit India movement. If he was not granted even a meeting, he wrote, he might crucify the flesh by fasting. In response, the Viceroy accused the captive of having unleashed a sad campaign of violence and crime. That Gandhi himself advocated non-violence was no answer to relations of those who have lost their lives and to those themselves who have lost their property or suffered severe injury as a result of violent activities on the part of Congress and its supporters. Gandhi responded that the authorities had goaded the people to the point of madness. Still, the Viceroy's allegations rankled him, and he announced a fast of 3 weeks. He wished not to fast unto death, but to survive the ordeal if God so wills. And to that end, he would drink water with a little citrus juice to make it palatable. Gandhi held 21 days to be the limit of his endurance, and appears to have seen the fast as a trial before God. The viceroy charged that it was an easy way out and a form of political blackmail. The war cabinet had long decided that if Gandhi chose to fast, he would be allowed to die. But some Indian members of the viceroy's council worried about Gandhi's perishing in prison, and Linlithgow fretted that they might resign their seats if he were at risk of dying. Such weakness infuriated Churchill, who raged on February 7. What did it matter if a few blackamoors resigned? We could show the world that we were governing. If indeed Gandhi died, we should be rid of a bad man and an enemy of the empire. His anger persisted into the next day's war cabinet meeting. The British had scored victory after victory in North Africa. The Soviets had fought the Nazis to a standstill, and the Americans were pounding the Japanese. And this, our hour of triumph everywhere in the world, he said, was not the time to crawl before a miserable little old man who had always been our enemy. The viceroy nevertheless proposed to release Gandhi from prison for the duration of his fast, an offer he declined. So the ordeal began, and as each excruciating day crawled by, Indians came to besiege the new American envoy with pleas for help. William Phillips once arrived at his office to find 25 agitated schoolgirls camped in the hall outside. He asked the viceroy for permission to visit Gandhi and was turned down. But when Indians realized that I could not intervene without instructions and that the president would not intervene with Churchill, American stock in India fell rapidly, Phillips recounted in a memoir. On February 19, he was finally able to hand Linlithgow a telegram from Cordell Hull, the American Secretary of State, expressing the president's alarm at the prospect of Gandhi's death. Linlithgow explained to Phillips that if Gandhi should die, the worst would be 6 months' unpleasantness, steadily declining in volume, little or nothing at the end of it. After it was all over, India would be far more reliable as a base for operations. The Prime Minister instructed Lord Halifax, the ambassador in Washington, to leave no doubt that any interference from the United States would cause great embarrassment between the two governments. Gandhi's moral stature nevertheless posed a serious problem to the British. Since he was holding out longer than expected, the Prime Minister asked the Viceroy to check if he was sneaking some glucose with his water. "Would be most valuable if any fraud could be exposed." Gandhi had refused glucose, Linlithgow responded. On February 21, the old man's condition suddenly worsened, but the crisis passed. A British doctor attested that one of the Indian doctors might have panicked when Gandhi appeared to be on the verge of death and secretly given him a dose of glucose, but the old man could not have known and so could not be exposed as a cheat. No matter. Churchill would write in The Hinge of Fate that it was certain, however, at an early stage, that he was being fed with glucose whenever he drank water. The Viceroy thanked the Prime Minister for standing firm against a wicked system of blackmail and terror practiced by the world's most successful humbug. Churchill had meanwhile come down with pneumonia and was on his own irksome diet. "I do not think Gandhi has the slightest intention of dying," he complained in a letter to Prime Minister Jan Smuts of South Africa, who 3 decades earlier had had his own share of troubles with the Indian. "I imagine he has been eating better meals than I have for the last week." As luck would have it, while the Prime Minister was down with pneumonia and irascible over Gandhi's fast, he received a complaint from Chirwal about the transportation of grain to India. Upon returning from Casablanca, the Prof had vehemently protested the shipping committee's promise to send the colony at least 40,000 tons of wheat. "The consignment would cost the United Kingdom dearly in terms of shipping," Chirwal argued, "and India's annual output of cereals was so enormous, a little above 50 million tons, that even the 600,000 tons that the Viceroy wanted could make no conceivable difference to its food supply. He trusted that no further gestures of this sort will be encouraged. Churchill concurred. I am much concerned about these heavy inroads into your shipping due to the improvidence of the various governments in the East concerned and the failure of their crops, he wrote to Leathers, the Minister of War Transport. I hope you will be as stiff as you can. There is no reason why all parts of the British Empire should not feel the pinch in the same way as the mother country has done. In his January memo to Leathers, Amory had noted that the food stringency in India was a result of high prices arising from the cessation of Burmese imports, crop failure, and the demands of the army and of Ceylon, all of it compounded by hoarding. With prices on the rise, cultivators were refusing to sell, while traders and householders were buying grain and storing it for future use, forcing prices even higher. Imports would render the army and part of the urban population less dependent on open market purchases of grain until the summer wheat was harvested, reducing prices and greatly alleviating the problem. Compared to Amory's incisive analysis, Cherwell's drop-in-the-bucket argument was shallow. Indeed, India's harvest was large. The problem lay in distributing it so that everyone got enough, which was more likely to happen if everyone was confident of getting enough. For instance, the people of the United Kingdom knew that their government would take care of them and felt no need to stockpile essentials. The residents of Bengal, in contrast, knew that famine was impending and were equally sure that the government would not take care of them. That awareness had led landowners to store grain for survival, unscrupulous agents to hoard for speculation, and the government itself to stockpile for the war effort. Had the war cabinet sent significant consignments of grain, it would have demonstrated a resolve to not let the colony starve and signalled that hoarding would be unprofitable. Those holding stocks in excess of their immediate needs would therefore have released them to the market, reducing prices and saving many lives. As it happened, the government of India had already announced that wheat was coming, so Leathers felt obliged to send some. But after arranging for ships to carry 26,000 tons from Australia to India, he found that amount adequate to meet the United Kingdom's immediate needs from the colony, and became reluctant to assign any more vessels. During 1943, the United Kingdom continued to draw tea, oil seeds, and cotton from India. Soon after, the government of India reported that the lifting of price controls had enabled it to procure enough grain for the time being. In view of the simultaneous grain crisis in eastern Africa, the Secretary of State for India asked the Viceroy to forego the shipments already promised. Linlithgow protested that India's grain reserves were so low as to threaten disaster in the near future. Rice crisis inevitable later in the year, and additional shipments of wheat will be essential to help to meet this, he wrote to Amory on February 21, 1943. India's own need is so acute that I must press for retention of all tonnage allocated to us already, and repeat that further substantial allocations will be necessary later on. But on March 2, after hearing a member of the Viceroy's Council warn of famine, the shipping committee asserted that no further diversions of ships from the United Kingdom import program could be contemplated at present. The Indian Ocean shipping cut saved the United Kingdom from impending calamity, at least as Donald McDougall of the S-Branch told the story. The imports, after falling to a terrifyingly low level for about 4 months, started arriving in increasing quantities just in time. Our stocks, after plummeting in an equally alarming way, levelled off just above the minimum safety level before starting to recover slowly, he wrote in his memoir. McDougall was referring to civilian stocks having reached their lowest point in March 1943, when they were still 3.1 million tonnes above the level of 11.5 million tonnes considered essential by the shipping committee, and 4.8 million tonnes above the level of 9.8 million tonnes considered essential by the Ministry of Production. and as it happens, even these so-called safety levels of stocks were inflated. It is clear, in retrospect, that minimum food requirements were considerably, and raw materials requirements wildly, overstated. Historian W. K. Hancock and economist M. M. Gowing would comment in their official history of the British war economy. The shipping transferred from the Indian Ocean would add 2 million tons of supplies by the end of the summer. That is, the shipping cut that contributed to the outbreak of famine in Bengal merely added to the margin by which stocks were in excess in Britain. Stocks had originally been viewed by the Ministry of Food as a way to tide over the early difficulties of the war until the dividends were apparent from the Grow More Food programme, which expanded the area under cultivation in the British Isles. But as the war wore on, the purpose of the stocks and the stipulated size had altered. Chowell, for instance, saw these food reserves, along with stocks of raw materials needed by factories, not so much as insurance against hard times, but as savings that would enable full use to be made of strategic opportunities. We should strive to build up our stocks so as to be in a position to divert large masses of shipping for military purposes if the occasion arose, he wrote in a memo. In his view, which prevailed, stocks should be maintained at levels well above those stipulated by the ministries, so that the War Cabinet could retain flexibility for meeting emergency needs in a period of large-scale military operations. In June 1942, for instance, the Shipping Committee had formulated a plan to run down existing reserves. It thought that between January 1942 and June 1943, stocks could be reduced by 6 million tons before they reached the level estimated for indispensable working stocks, wrote Hancock and Gowing. By the summer of 1943, the United States would be producing an abundance of ships, supplies could be swiftly ferried across the Atlantic Ocean, and stocks should no longer be so necessary. But the War Cabinet worried that the Americans might not provide the necessary shipping. If so, food reserves might never be rebuilt to former levels, and the government would have no elbow room for strategic operations to take advantage of any sudden weakening of the enemy. The Prime Minister inveighed against tightening the belt, while the Prof demanded at least 27 million tons of imports in 1943, more than ever before. Another reason for maintaining large stocks and the corresponding claim on shipping was the Prime Minister's distaste for austerity. In the summer of 1940, for instance, the Ministry of Food had estimated that it needed 15 million tons of imported food and animal feed each year. But at the urging of Churchill and Chowell, it had asked for almost 19 million tons. British rations would come to include red meats, butter and other fats, cheese, tea, sugar, jam and other preserves. Prices were controlled for bread, milk, eggs, poultry, rabbits, frozen cod, canned salmon, herring, canned pork and beans, spreads made of fish and meat, preserved vegetables, potatoes, onions, rice, lentils, tapioca, sago, biscuits, macaroni, and other noodles, canned soups, pickles, sauces, relishes, coffee, cocoa, honey, custard powder, jelly, dried fruit, nuts, oranges, and lemons. Rations and price controls required that stocks of at least the non-perishable commodities be maintained. Despite all this effort and expense, however, Americans had access to more meat, eggs, and fresh fruit than did Britons, a disparity that irked the Prime Minister. Sensitivity to the public's tastes consumed additional tonnage on Allied vessels. Nutritionists argued, for instance, that the fraction of wheat grain used for bread flour, called the extraction rate, should be increased so as to enhance the intake of iron and vitamins. Raising the extraction rate would also cut wheat imports and thereby save shipping. But Britons preferred soft white bread, baked out of no more than 80% of the flour that whole wheat could yield, so It was not until the spring of 1942 that the extraction rate was increased to 85%. The Ministry of Food banned a further increase to 87%. That economy would save shipping space and thereby weaken our bargaining power in that we should immediately be called upon to surrender an equivalent amount of shipping, one official argued. American officials at the Combined Food Board, an agency based in Washington, D.C., that coordinated the Allies' distribution of food, had grown suspicious of British import requirements, which meant that every ton of shipping had to be fought for, sometimes for its own sake. The Ministry of Food also resisted the rationing of bread, which it regarded as the last resort of a starving nation. The Prime Minister himself had spoken for such rations in July 1942. He fretted that people might feed chickens with the cheap and plentiful bread. Rationing would reduce such wastage and save a large quantity of shipping. Lord Woolton, a businessman whom Churchill had appointed the Minister of Food, responded at a war cabinet meeting that he could save 800,000 tons of shipping by other means if he chose to, and he would prefer that to rationing bread. Bread rations were introduced only after the war. Diluting the wheat flour used for baking bread with flour from homegrown barley and potatoes would also save shipping and improve nutrition. But barley was needed for beer, which was necessary for morale, and officials unanimously recoiled at the prospect of pubs closing for 2 days a week. Instead, brewers were persuaded to supplement their barley with oats. These deliberations and negotiations took time, so it was not until January 1943 that the order went out to replace 5% of the wheat flour used for bread making with flour made out of potatoes, oats, barley, and rye. The 5% was subsequently increased to 10%. It saved 284,000 tons of shipping over 9 months, although most of the saving came after the summer when ships became more available again. The sole sacrifice that ordinary Britons were asked to make in response to the shipping crisis of 1943 was to eat multigrain bread. Historian Kevin Smith maintains that the War Cabinet's panic over food and other reserves was nevertheless understandable in light of the heavy and ongoing losses of Allied merchant vessels to German U-boats. In January 1943, no one could have foreseen that 3 months later the battle against the submarines would be won, and ships would thereafter ply in relative safety across the Atlantic. Be that as it may, the remarkable rate at which the United States was producing ships had been expected to render the shipping losses to U-boats irrelevant by the summer, and by that count alone stocks were ample. More than 4 million tons higher at the end of 1942 than the quantity of food and raw materials the British economy would consume during the next half year. In retrospect, it is clear that the threat to British rations posed by the shipping crisis was exaggerated. Take, for instance, the discrepancy between the stock estimates that the S branch provided to the War Cabinet and the figures that the War Cabinet provided to the U.S. government. On January 8, 1943, Churchill stated in a draft paper that domestic reserves are now only 3 million tons above the minimum working level absolutely required, and would continue for several months to dwindle by 750,000 tons a month unless remedial steps were taken. On March 9, in a draft paper prepared for use by the Foreign Secretary in his dealings with American authorities, Churchill again asserted, "By April it seems likely that we shall be down to about 750,000 tons above the minimum safety level." This estimate is consistent with the previous one if the gains from the cut to Indian Ocean shipping are ignored. But the final version of this paper stated, "By April, it seems likely that stocks will be nearly 1 million tons below the minimum safety level." This was an extraordinary claim, given that in March, stocks were 2 million tons above the minimum of about 12.5 million tons, implicit in the S-branch calculations of January. The War Cabinet went on to warn of living from hand to mouth. Any further drop and the wheels would cease to turn and rations would be jeopardized. If the food reserve situation was not as critical as claimed, what contingency actually motivated the Indian Ocean shipping cut? In internal documents, the Statistics Division and the Ministry of War Transport cited the real reason as operational flexibility. As Smith explains, an atmosphere of distrust between British and American shipping authorities had made the War Cabinet uncertain of whether the President would keep his promise of extra ships for the United Kingdom import programme. In addition, much acrimony prevailed around which of the desired military operations would actually take place. In such circumstances, it made sense for Churchill and Chirwell to hold on to as much shipping and stocks as they could, so that the War Cabinet could pursue military objectives for which the Americans might decline support. Indeed, when in March 1943 General Charles P. Gross, who determined shipping allocations for the United States Armed Forces, learned of the President's promise of 7 million tons for the British civilian import program, he expressed himself in such forceful terms that his remarks were left off the record. Such a large call on shipping threatened the entire strategic program agreed upon at Casablanca. Gross alleged that the United Kingdom could get by on 16 million tons of imports for 1943 instead of the 27 million tons that it demanded as the first charge on Allied shipping. Furious about what it regarded as British deviousness in having directly approached the President, the US military resisted the handover of ships. The notes on War Cabinet meetings that were released in 2006 point also to an economic factor as having bolstered the need to retain ample stocks. The extent to which the United Kingdom's indebtedness threatened its post-war well-being. After the war, Europe would need large infusions of food, world prices would be high, and for the United Kingdom to be importing food at that time would prove costly. Rather than let domestic food stocks run down as the war turned in the Allies' favour, in July 1942, Churchill had resolved to build them up by accepting Chirwell's formula of requiring 27 million tons of civilian imports in 1943. Whatever reserves happened to be left at the end of the war would help feed the United Kingdom. Surplus stocks would also be worth a lot on the world market. On January 5, 1943, the War Cabinet discussed an American plan to create stockpiles for feeding liberated Europe. Gathering these supplies without provoking a price rise would require the United States to extend rationing, and officials had asked for a British gesture to help put this across to their people. An S-branch memo composed the day before the meeting noted that the Chancellor of the Exchequer had cautioned against making promises to the United States about the disposal of any stockpiles of commodities we may hold at the end of the war, as these will be our only liquid assets. At the meeting, Lord Woolton said that the United Kingdom might have to continue rationing after the war, but Americans would still be enjoying more ample portions. Why should we bind ourselves to rationing more severe than US impose upon themselves? Churchill retorted. The transcripts are abbreviated. We have done our share already, nor was it wise to promise contributions to Europe. Do we want to pledge ourselves in advance to give away our only liquid assets? Don't want to promise free gifts. Many countries could pay, countered an official. We can build up stocks of some commodities here and in Empire. We can promise contributions from those stocks, added the Minister of Production. On that very day, the Prime Minister instituted the shipping cut in the Indian Ocean. Unless the Americans provided a great deal of extra shipping, the goal of 27 million tons of imports could not be met, the Prof warned on January 8. Restriction of shipping to the eastern theatres will therefore have to be maintained to a very considerable extent throughout the year. That would be well after the stock stringency anticipated for the spring had passed. So it was concern about the United Kingdom's post-war finances, not just about wartime food supply or operational flexibility, that motivated the determination to build domestic stocks by cutting Indian Ocean shipping. In making their decision, the Prof and the Prime Minister exported as much as possible of Britain's future economic risk to the colonies, where it precipitated immediate catastrophe. During the first half of 1943, the United Kingdom would receive two-thirds of the goods that were loaded at North Atlantic ports. British stocks of food and raw materials, after dipping to a low of 14.6 million tons in March, increased steadily to reach an all-time high of 18.5 million tons in December. Such levels of reserves had to be repeatedly justified to American officials who questioned British appetites. The explanations involved elasticity in the definition of a key quantity, the working stock. As R.J. Hammond described in the official history of Britain's wartime food supply, the most essential stocks were of the working or distributional type needed to maintain the smooth flow of commodities. For instance, a dockside warehouse needed to be sufficiently empty that it could absorb goods whenever a ship arrived to unload, but also full enough that it could disgorge goods to trucks any time they showed up to load. Working stocks were the sum total of such reserves. The exigencies of war required, in addition, contingency stocks to allow for sudden difficulties. In practice, the Ministry of Food lumped working stocks together with contingency stocks to define a quantity that it insisted was an absolute minimum. This figure was actually much higher than necessary. Hammond noted, for instance, that although in the first months of war the stocks of wheat available to mills had fallen to 260,000 tons, the vast majority of mills had kept on going. But in 1943, the ministry insisted that it needed 850,000 tons of working stocks alone. And although 1942 saw a record harvest of wheat, 2.5 million tons, and 1943 topped even that, the ministry ignored the home crop in its calculations, almost doubling its secret margin of safety. Nor did estimates of bread consumption allow for the gigantic output of potatoes, 10.1 million tons in 1942, large quantities of which would be fed to pigs. The Ministry of Production similarly inflated the stock requirements of industrial raw materials and defined a distributional minimum that it put forth as irreducible. The Prof referred to an analogous but even higher quantity as the minimum safety level or danger level, at once rendering it sacrosanct. In truth, had stocks fallen below even the real minimum working level, there still remained some additional economies the government could impose, noted Hancock and Gowing. Unfortunately, every ton of food unnecessarily earmarked for working stocks was condemned to uselessness only less surely than if it had been destroyed, commented Hammond. Millions of tons of supplies had to be held in storage in the British Isles and could not be consumed even